Welcome to this episode of Fossils and Fiction, a podcast that explores the stories of prehistoric life, most often through the stories we humans tell about it. It's produced by me, Travis Holland, with support from Charles Sturt University. Enjoy. Hi, I'm Travis Holland. In this episode of Fossils and Fiction, I chat with Clemson University English lecturer Peter Cullen Bryan about The Land Before Time. Along the way, we divert into healthy discussion of Disney and trace The Land Before Time's place in the phylogeny of dinosaur film, with links to Fantasia, Jurassic Park, and more. Enjoy! Peter, thanks for joining me. Like myself, you're a researcher with interests in fan studies and adaptations and the like, but before we get to the topic of the day, tell me a bit about your work.
Sure. So I'm primarily a Disney person. I do a lot of research on Disney, particularly the comics. My first and currently only book is about the translations and sort of cultural adaptation of Donald Duck comics, the Karl Barks stories into German, and then sort of the cultural exchange that occurs later on in the 80s and 90s. So I do a lot with animation and comics in that vein. While I would say that Don Bluth and Land Before Time aren't strictly Disney, Bluth being a Disney animator and this being kind of part of the 80s landscape is a key point of interest to me, and something that I think is a rather fertile ground that really hasn't been explored too much.
Yeah, it's The Land Before Time is a piece of paleo media which holds so much nostalgia for so many. And I think a lot of people who don't pay attention to these things perhaps assume it is a Disney property, mm-hmm. you know, because it does bear some of those sort of hallmarks. So the film was released in 1988, and there are a bunch of sequels and TV series and games. I think we'll probably focus just on that first one, otherwise we'd be here all day. The original film was directed by Don Bluth, as you mentioned, and executive produced by, interestingly enough, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, and others. Why do you think The Land Before Time is so special?
So in my own case, this may be the first film that I saw in theaters. I know I saw it in theaters. The only caveat there is this came out the same day as Oliver and Company, the Disney, the big Disney release for 1988. I know I saw both of those, but this is one that sticks with me. And I think almost everyone of my generation has seen this movie. I know that the VHS shows up in, you know, I remember kind of it being a omnipresent, whether you're in a dentist office or daycare or at school, everybody seemed to have the VHS of this. I know it was cheaper than sort of the higher end Disney releases. And there is that, you know, sort of cultural, this larger cultural deluge of dinosaurs that is ongoing at this point. We're still 5 years away from Jurassic Park, although, as we mentioned, Steven Spielberg's involved here too. And according to Don Bluth in his autobiography, Spielberg's the one that comes up with the idea for this film, mm-hmm. and says, technology's not there for live action dinosaurs yet, but I think we can do this as an animated film. So there is this kind of, it's part of this larger movement that's going to lead up to Jurassic Park and maybe dates back further to something like Land of the Lost. I mean, it's always kind of this dinosaur media, but I've seen you talk in some of the other episodes about this larger movement and sort of the rise of as you say, a paleoculture of dinosaurs as being sort of omnipresent, and I think this is a key part of that evolution.
Yeah, I've quite interested. I now realize I should have mentioned The Land Before Time. I have a conversation article which is being published for Jurassic Park's 30th anniversary, so it'll be out in a couple of days as we're recording, but a couple of weeks in the past as this is published. And I now realize I should have mentioned the Land Before Time as part of the build up to what I was mentioning about Jurassic Park, but I'm glad we got to it here. You mentioned as well that the film is quite emblematic of 1980s business. How do you think that plays out?
This is, so those of you that don't know, Don Bluth is a former Disney animator, leaves the studio, I believe it's 81, 82. It's around the time of the Fox and the Hounds release, and ends up doing Secret of NIMH and eventually working with Spielberg on An American Tale and continuing with this. So there is this, sense of animation kind of coming into its own. Animation's always existed, but Disney kind of is going through a bad period leading up to this point. They're starting to kind of recover. There is the Michael Eisner's taken over by now. But this is the first point, or really, I'd say with An American Tale, and then followed by this, that Disney really starts to have competition. To the point that they, as I mentioned earlier, release Oliver and Company, their big tentpole, on the same day, probably as a way to undercut this film. They often did the same thing before and after this, of either re-releasing a Disney classic or releasing a new film, to the point that I think All Dogs Go to Heaven, which will be the next Bluth after this, comes out the same day as The Little Mermaid. So there is that kind of aspect of the Disney starting to come into its own as this omnipresent social force, this cultural force in a way that it hadn't before, and really trying to create an animation empire.
Yeah, the almost that not to put words into your mouth here, but they're almost becoming that kind of atypical 80s ruthlessness business, and they're displaying that with these releases trying to kill off the rival animators.
Yeah, and it's something that's still it's common in the film business. It still happens today, where you'll have the studios will try superhero films more recently, but the tendency to try to release kind of counter program or throw a wrench in the works, that doesn't always work the way it's expected, and it'll get far worse by the end of the 90s.
Yeah. It's far
The
less of
other
an
thing I'm,
issue for Disney now when they have two-thirds of the slate at most cinemas,
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah. They figured out how to solve this problem by just buying up Fox and Pixar and various other studios. But so it's also Disney also figures into the toys, where this is a period where we're starting to see the rise of merchandising. We're starting to see the McDonald's tie-ins, famously, to the point that, there is talk of a Land Before Time Happy Meal. It doesn't happen because Disney, again, scoops him with Oliver and Company. So the toys in question that we see for this film, or the ones that I remember, and I imagine a lot of children of the 80s remember, are the Pizza Hut puppets. They're these sort of larger, like hand puppets. And I do. I think you have a commercial for the show notes.
In the new movie, The Land Before Time, Littlefoot, Sarah, Ducky, and Spike share an incredible journey. Along the way, they become best friends.
Now we'll always be together.
And now these lovable characters can be your child's friends too. With a pizza from Pizza Hut, a Land Before Time dinosaur is only 99 cents. So come to Pizza Hut. Your friends are waiting.
We'll always be together. Pizza Hut, make it great.
But that is kind of that sense memory of that period that when I think of this film, I'm thinking of both the movie itself and the VHS, and but also these pretty hardy, rough and tumble puppets, to the degree that I think there still are a few lurking in my parents' basement from some 30 plus years ago now.
I'm going to have to jump on eBay and look up a couple of those. The Bluth animation style and perhaps the tone of the films are quite different from the Disney ones, though. You get this, perhaps this is why they've lingered for so many people, despite being sort of smaller productions, is they have a real sense of emotion, perhaps. They let emotion linger, I think, longer than Disney films often do. Is that, would you agree with that?
Yeah. I think that there is... yeah, I've seen Bluth described as sentimental or even sappy at times, but there is a stronger element of that. It's a way that Disney will eventually start leaning into a little more with the Disney Renaissance, or Little Mermaid, and so on after that, that I think is a response to the Bluth style and these sort of big emotional moments. Not to say that Disney didn't have those before, but I think it's a key point that the tends to be a little more brisk, whereas these draw it out. I think of something like in this film, The Death of Little Fitz's Mom is a long sequence compared to something like The Death of Bambi's Mom, which is essentially happens off screen. We never see the body in that case.
And that was exactly the comparison I was thinking of. Of course, it's, you know, the killing Bambi's mom is a kind of famous meme nowadays because it evokes that emotion straight away. But as you say, it's off screen. Whereas when we see Littlefoot's mum die, it's slow, it's drawn out. He's there. He's breathing every moment of that. He's already at that point. One of the last four members of his herd, and then it becomes himself and his grandparents, but he's separated from them. So there's this sense of loss overwhelming. The world around them is changing, the plants are failing, they're all migrating, and then it says Littlefoot and his parents are the last of his herd. But as you find out, it's just them. It's just him, his mother, his grandparents, and then his mother dies in the confrontation with the sharp tooth. And then you've got Sarah, who also is separated from her parents during that same earthquake, but she has quite a different style of operating around her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a key point that something this film does that, again, we don't really see in Disney until later. It has a wide cast. We have five sort of major dinosaurs. Not all of them talk. I think four of the five do. But they all have their distinct personalities. They all have different ways of dealing with this. They're all separated from their herd or their people in some way. And this is really building on what Bluth did in American Tale, which was one mouse separated in a big city, and now we're seeing a whole group that all respond in different ways and get angry at it, get bad at each other. Near the end of the film, the group splits up in this sort of relatable moment, but they all feel like kids in a way that often gets lost. All of these dinosaurs feel like children in a way that I think is easy to empathize with for kids, that you can look at these characters and go, okay, yeah, maybe you don't think of yourself as Sarah because she's kind of a bully, but there are aspects of that that maybe in hindsight you look and say, okay, yeah, that was me. I was hard-headed and always wandering off on my own. But I think that is part of the appeal.
They're not really stereotypes, but they're very different archetypes, all of the five main dinosaurs. And they all have different circumstances. I mean, the inventiveness in figuring out different ways to separate that many dinosaurs from their families is quite well done, I think, as well. So, what do you think the legacy of the film is nowadays?
Well, it's certainly, a key part of popular culture. It's one that talked about the idea of dinosaurs. It's maybe been displaced a little bit by something like Jurassic Park, which is later and bigger. And this is one that I think, it has 20 sequels or whatever and goes on forever. But it's one that still has that connection. So, I think you found me or roundabout way because we did a live tweet of the film with a group called Historians at the Movies on Twitter a few weeks ago, or maybe a month or two ago now, whenever you're listening to this. That talked about, okay, what's the, what was the appeal of this? Why did this matter? How does this fit into the larger pop cultural narrative? I think this does still linger. I mean, Littlefoot is still a known quantity. Sarah is still a character that people are familiar with. And it has maybe displaced, one of the influences that I believe talks about for this is Fantasia, which has the sequence of the dinosaurs in the desert and a very wordless sequence where they all, sort of reflecting that extinction. But I think this has kind of taken that place as, oh, this is what dinosaurs were like. And it does have a way, I think we kind of need this film to get to Jurassic Park and in particular the Jurassic World series, because it humanizes dinosaurs in a way that kind of hadn't been done before. They get personalities, they get characters. And it does slowly build, gives us, okay, if we can accept these animated dinosaurs as lost children and empathize with them, by the time we get to Jurassic World, we can say, okay, yes, Blue the Velociraptor is, has a personality, is not just a raptor, and gaining this understanding of, dinosaurs can be anthropomorphized in a way that hadn't quite been done much before this point.
And even I hadn't really thought much about it, but the animated series Camp Cretaceous, I don't know if you've seen that, but the role of Bumpy, the blue ankylosaur, who's a bit of an outcast in and of herself, Henry Wu rejects her because she's imperfect, because she doesn't have perfect horns on her head. But she really becomes part of the kind of cast of human characters characters. So, yeah, absolutely. It's really nice to be able to trace these lineages. And as you say, there's that connection to Fantasia. There's a shot here, and we've kind of talked around this, but this is in some way Spielberg's dinosaur movie before Jurassic Park, but it was one specific shot when I was rewatching Land Before Time a couple of weeks ago, where the Sharptooth, as they call it, or the Tyrannosaur, pushes down on this branch, and the kids are underneath it pushing back up, and it's almost exactly the shot from Jurassic Park of Lex and Tim in the car pushing up on the Perspex as the Rex pushes down.
Yeah. I think there is a lot of, in some ways this may be a test run for Jurassic Park. We get some of the same, kids separated from parents, stuck in this dangerous world, being hunted by a T-Rex is pretty, half of the plot of Jurassic Park. I don't know. I'm sure there's some interview somewhere where Spielberg talks about how everything connects, but it does seem like a lot of things, if this was a movie that was pitched by Spielberg that had his, as with the American Tale, had a pretty direct hand of Spielberg in there. It's not just a name on this movie. He is involved in this. He is part of the production. He is looking over stuff to the point that he may be responsible for a lot of scenes getting cut short in this movie. There is a fair amount of this is a like 85 minute movie or something. It's very short, even for an animated film. that probably less than 85, but it's a short film in part because of some cuts that were made. But there is still that those fingerprints all over this. This is a Spielberg movie, and it is maybe a proof of concept for Jurassic Park. Okay, here's the, you know, this scene worked. This, you know, these aspects worked. We're going to change this around. We're going to add that. But there is that sense of, you know, this is part of that evolutionary process in a way that might not seem obvious at first glance, but I think that's a key point.
Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall were also involved, who of course have had you know, great involvements in the Jurassic series, as well as a bunch of other major franchises since. So but yeah, both of them pop up in the credits for this film as well. So it's almost the dinosaur preschool before you go on to the Jurassic series, which is something that, yeah, I think a lot of people, having grown up with and loved the movie, might not have made that connection. So,
yeah, and I think that's a key idea there. You know, both have these connections that then, you know, Kathleen Kennedy also got ties back to Star Wars and kind of this larger apparatus of Edie's filmmaking. And I think this also gets, it's a key point there too, that this, you're talking about that idea of the T-Rex pressing down as they're pushing back up. There are scary moments in this movie in a way that you don't really get in this period of Disney movies. That does, again, maybe lead in at preschool, you know, kind of the younger audience, gets them ready for Jurassic Park, for the loud noises, for the T-Rex chasing the car. And having these moments of peril here that we kind of, maybe feels a little more safe because it's cartoon dinosaurs, but it does maybe inadvertently or maybe intentionally prepare the audience, you know, younger audience, for the next crop of dinosaur movies. Yeah.
So it comes at the end of that period of the dinosaur renaissance from the 60s through the 80s, which is kind of science-based, but it was also the re-emerging into pop culture and becoming this huge kind of part of pop culture, and as you say, omnipresent features in toys, in films, in TV, in games, in just about everything. So the film is obviously a kid's movie, but it deals with those really heavy themes that, as we've always kind of mentioned, do you think that by addressing those themes through the animated dinosaurs, that's a good way to introduce some of these concepts to kids?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to deal with death with kids. I just recently lost my mother. So it is, you know, something that's always going to hurt. But this is a way of be preparing kids for the world in small ways. I think there is sometimes this adage, and we got to shelter the kid. We can't expose them to this. But death is an inevitability in life. It's in the nature of things. Eventually, there's going to be sort of this end point. And this does show it in a way that Disney rarely does. It's maybe Mufasa in Lion King, which is what 6 years after this movie, sort of that shows that on-screen death. But there's this, you know, within this moment, we don't get a lot of these depictions. It's a lot of times the classic Disney death is villain falls off a cliff into the smoke below. Here we see violently Littlefoot's mom be killed in a way that, you know, it is pretty brutal. It's a pretty tough fight.
Yeah.
And shows the aftermath of that. We do get Littlefoot's mom kind of giving those dying words, but also showing that death is, it's bold, it's unusual. It's not something that you're seeing in a lot of children's media. That's a problem. It's, even today, we tend to kind of downplay or keep things off screen. Some shows are doing, you know, kind of getting better about engaging with this, but it's rare for something like this that I think is directed primarily at a younger audience at that elementary school, maybe age, to show something like this very starkly. But that I think that is part of the cultural contribution of this, that this is more than Bambi's mom, maybe for, again, the sort of 80s kids, this first brush with death that is necessary in some ways, that we need to have these conversations. And say Western society is not always so good at having the hard conversations about death and coming to terms with that.
You mentioning the Lion King and Mufasa's death, we also get that parallel moment later on where Littlefoot's mum kind of appears in the sky, which is again mimicked. And one of my favourite Simpsons references of all time, when they also do the same thing in The Simpsons later, much later on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that is important, that because this is also Disney is watching what Bluth is doing and trying to respond to that, and maybe directly lifting from it in that case, although Lion King has a lot of borderline plagiarism in it. That's a whole other discussion. But yeah, I think that's a key point. We get that moment that, you know, probably does, you know, the face in the clouds, or in this case, it's more of a shape than the actual form, the actual James Earl Jones lion head. But that is a key point, that we're seeing these ideas introduced here that then spread out, that recur, that are adapted, recreated, brought into new forms, and maybe we wouldn't without this. And I think it's the case. I think without Bluth, we probably don't get a Disney Renaissance the way we do. We probably don't get, if he's not kind of pushing back and doing his own thing and making a lot of money. This film in its opening weekend does beat Oliver and Company at the box office. It does eventually, long term, Oliver and Company will overtake it, but it does. It's a shot across the bow of Disney at a time when they're starting to reorganize, that I think does eventually improve the art of Disney in a way that we're still seeing today.
Thanks so much to Peter Cullen Bryan for that interview. Information about Peter's work is available in our show notes, as well as a link to some other material of relevance to our discussion. I hope you're enjoying this renewed paleo media focus for Fossils and Fiction. I think it's a fruitful and interesting vein of discussion for this podcast and for my own research. I'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback via a voice note or message through social media. Take care. Thank you for listening to this episode of Fossils and Fiction. We're always looking for more paleo stories to tell and welcome your suggestions through our social channels. You can also send voice notes via Spotify or social media. Podcast theme music is Sonora by Quincas Morea via the YouTube Audio Library. Show notes are available on the website, fossilsfiction.co. Please subscribe and rate the podcast on your preferred podcasting platform.